I can start a little bit here. My presentation, what I'm going to do is it's going to start with kind of a big picture, kind of philosophical kind of approach of kind of what got me going in 1995 when I started the company, kind of out of a frustration of doing conventional engineering designs, having to put my PE stamp on it just to get a permit. And since that time, a lot of work we've been doing has fallen in the sustainable building realms. We've done dozens of sustainable projects around different parts of the United States. Of course, a lot of what we do is water related. So the sustainable point of the focus of our presentation, of course, will be on the water piece. So I'll talk about some of the philosophy and that kind of leads us to the type of designs that are considered sustainable. And then I'll give you some examples of projects that we've done. And the projects I chose were projects on the big scale, large developments, almost small communities that are going to be self-sustained on rainwater. So there it is.
Great.
So two of the main points, there's two things that I kind of wanted to leave with you. One is thinking about closed loop systems. And not only closed loop water systems, but of course water relates to everything we do. So part of this will be talking about closed loop on the nutrient system, because everything we do with water conveys a lot of the nutrients that we end up having to deal with. So that'll be kind of a summary kind of concepts and ideas, hopefully, that you'll pick up as I go through my presentation. And then the other question I leave with you, which I'll start with, which will also be talked about in quite a bit of detail, is what should we do with rainwater after the first use of it? I know we're here, there's a lot of technical stuff we're going to be hearing about at the conference about the best ways to take rainwater, collect it, harvest it, treat it. But what do we do after that first use? So I'll start there and go with the... So holistic engineering, that's our approach that we use for all of our projects. And the root word of holistic is really whole systems approach, whole idea, you know, the whole looking at the whole picture. And when you get into sustainable building projects, first when we work with architects and other design experts on projects, it's all about integrating systems together. And then, of course, engineering, what we're trying to do, hopefully, as engineers, is to bring the resources and properties of matter and sources of energy into useful humankind and system structures, machines, and hopefully we do it in a way now that will be more sustainable, perhaps, than what we've been doing in the past. So the big picture of what it all the things you need to look at when you're looking at a system or something that you're going to try to approach. And what I've learned through the years is as an engineer, a lot of what we do is falls in the science and technology part, and we'd always try to come up with the best ways to do things. But I've learned often that what hinders us the most of trying to get some of the things that we're talking about this week is the laws and regulations and the way that things were written. In the United States in the 70s, when there was a lack of water type of regulations, the Clean Water Act was enacted, and a lot of good things came out of that. But a lot of those approaches that and systems that were designed were really the end of the pipe kind of an approach, because all the pipes were there and there was no really control or treatment over them. And part of what we're doing now, I feel like, especially the architect realm, the engineers are coming along, is really stepping back and going like, well, maybe there's a whole different way we can be doing the things we're doing and thinking from the beginning when we're doing our designs and our approach to development. What it takes to get the laws and codes changed is the politics and special interest. So it really, that's why that one is on the top, because when it all boils down to everything that we try to do and as engineers or rainwater people trying to get things done, it really, a lot of the hindrance that we have in a lot of places in the country is because of the codes and regulations are really have been developed in a different manner that promotes the kind of things we like to see done. We also look at the community issues, the economics. We've talked about the life cycle. It's one of the ways that we always help sell the ideas of what we're doing. If you take a long-term approach at the systems we're developing, often you can justify that type of sustainable method by the economics of it. And also, of course, the environment is a critical thing, and then the resources that we have to use. So that's kind of the summary of the holistic engineering approach. Now, when you start getting down into a project level or a system design level, some of the components and things that we get involved with when we do sustainable building projects, you know, we look at the whole system design. We look at how everything in a site, what's the relationship is to each other. Like I mentioned earlier, the integrated design, you look at the different components of a building. For example, when you're working with a team of designers, the architects have to work with you to, for example, to collect the roof water in a certain way that it goes into the system. The mechanical engineers often get involved with how the plumbing or the systems within the buildings work. Landscape architects, if we want to take some of that water out into the landscape areas. So it's quite different than a conventional way of designing things, because often the architect would just come up with a building, then they'd hand off the plans to the mechanical, and they, you know, try to go make it work, put the air conditioning in, and that sort of thing. But on a sustainable type of approach, everything, you look for the relationships and things, and everything becomes very much an integrated design approach. And then when you talk about sustainable design, you're looking at the type of materials you're using, how they're going to last, if they're toxic materials, that sort of thing. So those are kind of a summary of the things that you get involved with when you start looking at choosing types of systems or materials to do sustainable designs. Now, when you start looking at a certain system, this is a three-point criteria we had developed. One is we look at the economics. We compare the different choices that we have. We don't just look at the first cost, because that's kind of the way we've been doing things in the past, but we look at the long-term cost, how, and that gets into the life cycle. You know, how much is that going to take to not only build it, but operate it, maintain it, replace it. The other thing we look at when we're looking at the choices of alternatives is how environmentally friendly is the options that we're looking at. How ecologically compatible is it? And then the third, which is probably the most unique coming from an engineer, is how simple can it be to build it and operate it? And what we found when we use this criteria for doing our designs, it leads us to ecological or ecosystem-based solutions. Basically, we're just mimicking the natural systems that we see. They tend to be simple, self-sustaining. And then the other thing that we do is we have an approach where we try not to just treat the problem or the symptom of the issue, like in stormwater management, you know, there's these pipes and now we got all this erosion. Let's dig a hole at the end of the pipe and detain the water, slow it down. That's kind of a treating a problem. And what we'd like to do is let's just eliminate the problem by doing a better type of design. So one of the reasons I picked that we should be talking, and why we're talking about water, and it's been mentioned already, is just the growth rate of the earth. It's at a rate of about 10,000 people, new people, per hour on the earth. And I picked that up in about 1995. I went back and checked that, and we're still on that same kind of a pace, and that's a lot of people every day coming that we need to supply everybody's needs for. So supplying water for all that is very important. Oops. So one of the things I think is important, especially at a water conference, is to get everybody on the same page when it comes to different terminologies for water. And so I'll kind of go through this quickly, but there's all types of drinking water. There's the type of water that's piped to the site. That's municipal water, is typically like that. As you can see around here, there's a lot of water that's trucked to the site. There's bottled water. You think of the cost and the energy takes to get bottled water to you, and then what happens to that water after you drink it? What happens to that bottle after you use it? There's the extracted from ground, that's the well water. There's the collected on site, rainwater. Of course, that's where we're at. Stormwater is just general rainwater that runs off from sites. Rainwater, we talk about typically being the clean roof water. Wastewater, we feel like that's an outdated... Oh, what's going on? take a break. Go away. Yeah, wastewater is an outdated term. We shouldn't be using the word wastewater. It's not such a thing as waste. Waste just comes in different qualities, and that depending on the quality, you just find another reuse for it. So under wastewater, what we used to call wastewater, you talk about the different qualities of water that's out there. One is the black water, which is our typical water that we flush down the toilet. Got a mixture of in the urinals. So now it's black water. Brown water, and a couple of these things, I'm going to share some things. And when I was in Germany in this past May, you know, they've gone beyond us in a few areas of wastewater management. But they've got toilets that separate the urine out. And so the water that's mixed with the feces is the brown water. And then you've got the yellow water, which is the urine that's been separated at the source. And then you've got gray water. And there's light gray and dark gray. And we just define those because the light gray has less contamination or strength of water. So you get your bathtub, laundry. And your dark gray being the kitchen waste, which can have more material and solids in it. And then the combined water, which is our typical way of plumbing buildings and houses these days, is you just mix all the black water and gray water together. And then reclaimed water, which is really a thing that's being done a lot more, especially in sustainable type building practices, is that reclaimed water is defined as any type of treated wastewater, or these waters up here. You take those and you reuse those. And depending on the quality of the waste, I'm getting ahead of myself here. So anyway, this is a chart. This talks about all the different types of water sources. So there's a roof water, gray water, black water, bottled water. Those are all, when you keep them separate in different qualities, those are all certain types of water sources that can be used for certain specific reuses or uses. And then there's stormwater runoff, development, agriculture, road water. All these have different qualities because they've been tainted or contaminated in different ways. And over here we got roof water, gray water, black water, and complex water. When you get into industrial waters, there could be just about anything in that kind of water. So when you get to developing a sustainable water system, you know, this is a chart that kind of summarizes what a sustainable water cycle is. So once you know that there is no such thing as waste and everything is a type of source of water, you look at what kind of quality is. And let's take rainwater for example. If you took that rainwater, you could collect it and store it in a container, and perhaps you want to use that water for drinking. Well, then you have to go over here and do some treatment of it. Now it's ready for use. Well, now you've used it, perhaps you've washed something off in the sink, and now that water becomes a gray water, which goes back, now it's a different type of water source. If the stored rainwater that you have here is just going to be used for irrigation or toilet flushing, for example, maybe your treatment level is different or less or not at all, and then you can just reuse it directly. So it's the circular, the closed loop kind of water system that you look at for a sustainable water system. So why is there more talk in the United States and Canada about rainwater harvesting? Well, there's two newer types of building projects. We've already been talking briefly about the sustainable building projects. The LEED type, it's a rating system that's out there that ranks how green a building is. And then the other thing that's come from more of the engineering realm is for infrastructure development is the low impact development. And that one is geared more towards stormwater management. And in brief, the low impact development type of strategies that are out there is to, you know, develop with less impact. And that's building less. It's also using porous pavements so you don't have as much runoff issues. The root cause of most of our problems with stormwater management is the impervious surfaces that shed all the water. We've got probably 30 plus projects going right now, and every one of them but one has a porous pavement. I mean, that's just the way all of our projects boil down these days, is either porous pavements and or the next one, which is rain gardens, which is just putting that water back into the ground. I call it kind of a natural cistern system because the water just that we collect from the impervious surfaces, we put it into the rain gardens. And then the soil amendments is just replacing the topsoil layer that often gets stripped off in developments. Low impact foundations, that's just building your structures, your foundations that you're building slightly off the ground so that the flows from the water can continue like they did. And there's the green roofs, and then you actually get credits in stormwater management when you can do certain methods of rainwater harvesting. So this project we did, it's an educational facility. This is a LEED Gold project, but this is also an example of a cistern system that's used for just watering an organic farm, right, which is right behind there. So LEED, just briefly, was developed about 10 years ago as an architect kind of led way of promoting sustainable buildings and development. And in LEED, by doing more things, you get points and credits, and the more you get, the higher your project gets rated. The water section, as we've talked about already, there's not many points in there, and they're often hard to get. But a lot of the projects that we've been on, they were determined to get those points, and I'll show you our approach of how to get all the points in LEED. And just in summary of the 69 points, the platinum is the highest level. You can see you need to get at least 52 of the points. A lot of the points that are in there are for energy, being efficient with your energy systems, material selections, and that sort of thing. And here's the water points. It has to do with innovation, wastewater technologies, and water reuse. You also get points for reducing your demand over the baseline. So you can just get a few of the points just by using water conservation fixtures. But to get all the points, you really have to take it into in that innovative and water reuse type of category. So the other thing now that's coming along is we've been working with the Cascadia Regional Green Building Council, which is wanting to take LEED to the next level. And that's been called the Living Building Challenge. And so you've got LEED, you got the different layers of silver, gold, platinum. So we're working out here now in the living building and restorative design area. The living building, you can download the information about the living building from the Cascadia website, and I can give you more information about that after we're done here today or something. And it's a rating system that has six categories and 16 prerequisites. You basically just have to do all 16 of them to get your building rated as a living building. But those categories include site, which does have to do with some water issues, and then materials and types of materials, energy, indoor quality, here's the water segment, and then beauty inspiration. And that's one of the things too that I've seen as an engineer. Often the type of ways that things have been built, I think we could be doing a lot better to build things that are aesthetically pleasing rather than some of this, especially in stormwater management, some of the ways that the chain link detention ponds end up looking like. So here's a quick list of the 16 categories. I won't go through them all, but the main ones here that we're going to be talking about is down here in water. There's actually two of the 16 directly deal with water. And like I said, the site, some of these up here also deal with water. So there's a lot more water-related type of criteria in a living building. And one of the reasons for that is you could kind of summarize and boil down a living building into two general ways of thinking about it. It has to be a self-supporting building. It has to provide all of its own energy on site and all of its own water. So to do that, you have to use and reuse the water that you have there on the site. So one of the sections that's part of the living building is the water module. And the water module, a living building, is water independent. One of the prerequisites, 10, is net zero water. 100% of occupants' water use must come from captured precipitation. We know where that comes from. Reused water that is appropriately purified without the use of chemicals. And 11, sustainable water discharge. 100% of stormwater and building water discharge must be handled on the site. And I like these charts because they borrowed them from me, which I was surprised since I did these 1994. Sometimes you get ahead of people, but everybody's catching up. Living building, this is a list. We've been on so many lead projects that if you just boil down a design philosophy or principles and you kind of use this as a guide, you'll get all the points that there are in lead. Of course, in general, what we're trying to do is mimic the natural conditions. This one here, number two, is kind of the whole thing, is like, do not pee in the drinking water. And to do that, you either going to use reclaimed water that you've used on site and use it, treat it to a level for quality that's adequate for treating the toilet. Or the other one, which we've also used, is you don't use water to convey the waste. You use the composting toilet systems. There's different ways to do that. It really drops your demands. So if you do number two, you're going to get all the points that there are in lead. And then just to summarize that, you know, you're going to reuse and recycle all water sources that are impacted by human activities, and inherent to any water sustainable water system, as in rainwater harvesting, is you implement water conserving fixtures throughout, and highly water efficient type of systems. So a living building features, you know, a decentralized approach, small-scale systems. It's different than what's commonly used in most areas and cities. And what most engineers do for a living is do centralized approach type of systems, large-scale municipal systems. So I think now I just want to share this with you because, you know, I'd like to do a lot of research, and when you come across people or agencies are, you know, they're doing things that you've also been thinking about for a lot of your career, and then you get a chance to meet with them. So I went to Germany and got to share some of the stuff that we've been doing, and I got a presentation from an organization in Germany. It's a big agency, actually. I don't know if they got 6,000 employees or something, but GTZ, and one of their departments is called EcoSan, which they are doing work. A lot of third world countries, Africa and Asia. A lot of this stuff is happening also in Germany, Sweden, some of the countries in Europe as well. And it's really looking at some of the things we're talking about when you talk about sustainable whole systems, closing the loop. So I got a few of their slides I'm borrowing, but you know, all the statistics that we were aware of about all the urgencies of getting our water supplies to be safe and efficient. Here's our typical way of doing things these days, is our water is taken out of the ground, it's taken from rivers, our food supplies coming into the buildings from the farms, but then all that water and nutrients that come in just get maybe partially treated and then dumped in the river, but a lot of it just gets lost in unmanaged ways, and it's kind of the root problem with either contaminated groundwater or nutrients in rivers and lakes and things that start blooming algae and stuff because the nutrients are in the wrong place. So this is a chart that I really like that they've developed. And right on the top, and I think this is important, I mean, rainwater harvesting is like the beginning kind of step to coming up with a total sustainable type of system. So you collect your rainwater, you use it efficiently. You separate out all your sources of waste, your nutrients, your water types, and with some technology and handling of those systems or qualities of water and materials, you recycle those back into the environment in a safe, healthy way, and you keep that stuff out of the rivers and lakes and things that where it shouldn't be to begin with. So, summary of reasons, of course, for all this, but you look at material flow cycle instead of disposals, promotion of holistic interdisciplinary approaches, closing the loop, applies basic natural principles of closing the loop by using modern, safe sanitation reuse technologies, considers human excreta and wastewater not as waste but as natural sources. When they were given this presentation to me, I said, you know what, I think I could give your presentation, you could probably give mine. one of the things about urine separation, and this is one of the reasons I went to talk to them over there, because it's like, I got to find out what this is all about, because this is something that I've thought of, and I know there's some people that do this already in just their own homes. But a good part of the nutrient, or the nutrients of potassium, phosphorus, and nitrogen is in the small amount of urine that's in the water that typically gets flushed down the toilet. What's interesting here is that they've taken a look at the global need for nutrients in our agriculture, and here again trying to close the loop on the nutrient cycle, but the value of that the nutrients that we're typically flushing down the toilet or not using wisely, the value of that is $15 billion U.S. if you were to recover those nutrients. And of course, if we took those nutrients and used them in a healthy, safe way, we also don't need to rely on the mine type of nutrients that we're using, which are, I understand, are actually being used up. This is a neat little chart that they have separating out their qualities of rainwater, gray water, urine, feces, solid waste streams. And this is just a summary. They've got technical type of papers and information about where you see these bars and stuff. You can actually see some of the different ways that they're handling these different waste streams. Here's some toilets. They've got definitely two compartments. Typically, the front part, the urine goes, and the back part, this one goes to a composting system. These are just regular type of brown water systems there. Different countries, Sweden, Germany. Urine separation with waterless urinals is a very simple thing. It's done on a lot of projects, lead projects that we do. Why do you need water to flush urine? Here's capturing of those nutrients then and using them on site or a nearby site for aquaculture applications, hydroponics. It's all that different strengths of and quality of water being used appropriately. Here's the GTZ's new headquarter building, or one of their buildings, and I got to go through this one. This building here, this whole center corridor that has the urine separation system in it. Here's what the toilets look like. There's, I think, about 600 people that work in here. Waterless urinals. And this is just another slide I thought was useful relating to what we're talking about, is that if you do the things with water quality and separation, it helps reduce how much rainwater you have to put into the system. So these ideas of the EcoSan or the source separating works really well with what you're trying to achieve with the amount of rainwater that you can collect. This is also, I really like this one. This is showing on a project that they've separated out the different types of water. You've got the yellow water tank, the brown water tank, the gray water tank. I think one thing that's interesting is that they don't have the rainwater tank because they didn't have the rainwater piece yet. So I think we're kind of ahead of them in some ways in the rainwater compartment, but they're kind of ahead of us in the other type of separations. This is just simply the whole idea of the water loop, different uses, and then putting it back, and the nutrients being recycled back too. Just another slide here about how your the small amount of urine contains all the high load of all the nutrients. So that's the piece, and that's the reason why to separate it out, because it's much easier to find safe, easy ways to use it. Here's a building in Sweden. That toilet there, which looks like a normal toilet, actually goes to a composting unit and a urine separation system. Give you some project examples of ours now. This is a little kind of almost a closed loop system that we did in Whidbey Island in Washington State. It's a public restroom. It's got the solar panels enough to run all the little lights and gizmos that we have in there to run the system. It generates about 500 watts of energy. And we also collect the rainwater. And that rainwater is only used for flushing these 2 tablespoon per flush foam flush toilets that take the water down and the waste down into the composting units. All of the gray water, which is very minimal, but it's from the sinks and there's a drinking fountain outside, goes into a small little tank that has a small pump that pumps into a planter box underneath the roof of a building. So that's our gray water. We size the gray water planter box to use up all the water for zero discharge. Those are the kind of, oh, 1 minute. Uh-oh. Living machine. This is lead building. All the wastewater on the site gets recycled and treated within a building here. Toilet flush, the other one is Kansas City. What's interesting here is by recycling and conservation, we reduce our potable water demand 80%. Well, this is, we didn't have a rainwater system, but you can see you only need 20% of what it would be normal for the rainwater supply to provide the potable water for. So by doing reuse and recycling on site, you can see you can knock down the requirements for rainwater. Here's a large project. I won't have time to go through it. 300-acre development. The whole thing, it's got a golf course and everything, marina. I don't know, 900 people are going to live here. It's all rainwater harvested and treated and reused. Get our demands down to 70 gallons a day by recycling, recycled water for toilet flush. You guys have to talk to me later about all the system here, but we have a well there that's only a backup well because we were able to collect it all. Here's our distorted project in by Javi and rainwater system here in the island, collecting the roofs, and there's a cistern there. We've got different types of cisterns. Part of these were done before we got involved. Agricultural rainwater collections out in reservoirs. Here's our treatment system with a sand filter that's really interesting. UV for drink disinfection. So you get down to the codes need to be reasonable for a balance between human health, risk, environmental issues, and concerns. These are the kind of things we have to do on our projects. We have to warn people not to drink the water in the toilet if we use it reclaimed water in it. And that's the summary of what we deal with. So that's it.